Doug, just for the record, I'm just running some tape through here. Can you state mm-hmm. your name and spell it out for
us? My name is Douglas, Douglass Adair, Adair.
Are we beginning?
Yeah, fire away.
Okay, this is March 10th at 10:18 in the morning, and I'm Greg Truex, and I'm interviewing Doug Adair as part of the Oral History Project. That's just to get it on there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I would start out by asking a little bit about your background that leads up to your activities in the UFW. For example, just generally background things like who your parents were and grandparents mm-hmm. and things like that. Who were your parents and where were you born?
Born December 10th, 1942 in Princeton, New Jersey, and my father taught American history, especially the Revolution, the writing of the Constitution, the early Jeffersonian period. And before I was even 1 year old, we moved to Virginia, which his family had been from since the 17th century. And my mother's family had been Virginians that moved to Kentucky in the 1790s. So both of them, strong roots in Virginia going way back. And some members of the family had been slaveholders. Some had been Quakers, almost all for the Revolution in 1776, but the family very divided in the 1860s over the Civil War. My grandfather's father had served with the Union Home Guard in Kentucky, but most of the family had been with the South. And both my parents were college teachers. We moved to California in the 50s. And I graduated from Claremont High School in 1960.
Which high school?
Claremont High School. Yeah. And went to Pomona College, majoring in history, Phi Beta Kappa, 1964. And had a fellowship, a Woodrow Wilson fellowship, to go to, to continue my studies in history. And I went to Berkeley, UC Berkeley, was there for the free speech movement. In 1964, 65. And at that point, it was kind of being channeled towards a career in history, but what I really liked was gardening and being outside and working with plants. And I had an old 1935 Ford pickup truck and was kind of thinking I would give up school and be a gardener in the Berkeley Hills. And there were beautiful gardens up there, and I was very good at it. And I was living with an elderly lady, and I was her gardener. She was giving me free rent. And at that point, I was, politically, I was a registered Republican. My family was mostly Democratic, but I liked a guy named Tom Kuchel, who was senator at the time, and seemed like a pretty decent guy. And but I had been... Previous to that, had been pretty active in the Democratic Party, even in high school, and had gone into the convention center in L.A. and picketed for Adlai Stevenson in 1960, and had shaken Kennedy's hand, and so I was pretty active in Democratic politics in the late 50s, but had kind of gotten... Well, I'd gotten more conservative at Pomona, just in general, and was kind of drifting towards a kind of liberal, Republican, capitalist inclination. And the Republican group that I was a member of at Berkeley had a table in Sproul Plaza, where we were giving out literature on Kuchel, on Senator Kuchel. And the table next to us was the Student Committee for Agricultural Labor. And there was a young student there named Marion Moses who said, "Oh, Tom Kuchel isn't good at all. He's in favor of the Bracero program. And you must know how terrible that is." And I said, "Well, no, not really." And so she began giving me literature on that. And I'd read an article.
Excuse me, her name was Moses?
Marion Moses. She's going to be speaking at the seminar this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I'd read an article by Truman Moore in The Atlantic that spring that was called The Slaves We Rent, which had made quite an impression on me about agricultural labor. And Marion Moses suggested, oh, you should go to work in the fields in the Central Valley and learn what it's really like. And in that spring, they were just terminating the Bracero program, and the newspapers were full of articles from the growers about how, oh, a good farm worker makes $70, $80, $90 in a day, but Americans refuse to do this work. Americans won't do this work, and that's why we have to have braceros from Mexico. And I thought, oh, well, I'm an American, and I'd love to do this work, and $80 a day, that sounds good to me. Let's try it. So I signed up with this group, and we went to...
The group you signed up with was...
It's called the Student Committee for Agricultural Labor, and I think it had a brief history. That may have been the only year it existed. I don't know if it went on or not. And I hitched a ride thinking I wanted to do farm work. And most of the people in our group were people that just wanted to spend the summer doing something different. And... we checked in with the American Friends Service Committee in Visalia, and they found a basement of a church or somewhere for us to sleep in. And then eventually we got rooms in a labor camp, Linnell Farm Labor Camp in Farmersville. And we were picking peaches and plums, nectarines. The standard wage was $1.25 an hour. It was a 10-hour day. No unemployment insurance, no workman's compensation. In Social Security in those days, they could deduct the wages from your check, but they didn't have to turn them over to the Social Security Administration unless you worked at least 30 consecutive days or something or other. It was a complicated formula, I remember, because we would ask people, do they have Social Security or not? And they'd say no. But our check said they were deducting from our check. Well, yes or no? Well, it turned out the way the rules were written, at the end of a season, a farm worker would have to check with the Social Security Administration to see if that money was turned in or not. And if it wasn't turned in, it was his responsibility to go back to the labor contractor or whoever and get his money back. Well, and 99% of the labor contractors didn't turn the money in, unless you were a steady worker like a tractor driver or irrigator. But for the people in the crew that were just passing through, would work a week here, a week there, maybe 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there, but the system was built in so that the contractor would steal the money, which is exactly what happened.
And so the labor contractors to keep mm-hmm. money.
And the first kind of social service job I did in that crew was there was an old guy who had been getting Social Security and had gone to Mexico, and the checks had stopped coming, and he didn't know why. And he was the oldest guy in our crew. He was must have been in his 70s, and he was climbing the ladder to pick peaches. And his daughter or son, somebody in his family, was telling me the story, and I said, well, that couldn't possibly be right. I'll be glad to go with him to the Social Security the office in Visalia, see what happens. So we went in and talked to them, and they said, oh, well, if he was getting his checks in Mexico and we didn't hear from him for so many months or something or other, it was a time period, I think it was a year or 2 years, we stopped sending them, and we must have sent him a form that said he had to still be getting them, because we've had cases where people go to Mexico and they die, and the family keeps getting the check. So this was a procedure, and he has to reapply, and here's the paperwork, and here are the forms. And so we helped him get the forms and the paperwork, and the checks presumably started coming again. But it was just one of those typical little glitches where somebody had earned the benefits, you know, and for whatever reason wasn't getting them. And there was just no procedure in that society. There was nothing set up to help people with anything. My goodness.
And you just found this out and decided to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Doug, did you decide to help him because you found out about it, or was it part of a project to help this old man find out about it?
Oh, no, it was just, he was a member of the crew, and it was It must have been that his daughter or son came to us. I can't remember exactly why he came to me. And we began talking about it and thinking, I mean, I'd been brought up with standard, you know, this is the land of the free and the home of the brave and justice for all. And I hear something like that and I think, that's not right. Well, she said, he sure isn't getting the checks, and that's why he's climbing the ladder, and that's why he has to climb the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we checked it out, it wasn't right. But it took quite a bit of doing.
Did you have to go back?
It seems to me I only went in with them once and sat through it, and we figured out what was wrong and got the papers, and then they may have gotten papers through the mail that we helped them fill in. I don't remember, but I helped them fill in.
Do you feel like this sort of set up a path for you? I mean, this is the first time, or is it just part of what was already developing in terms of your interest and commitment to these sorts of issues?
Well, I see someone that needs help, I'm going to help them. If they have a flat tire, you know, I pull over.
So you feel like it was part of the way you were raised,
right,
and
your sure.
expectations for everybody.
But in the other side of the coin is that, gosh, within the crew, I'm sure now there were probably dozens of problems like this that I wasn't aware of, with people with family problems that I could have helped just because I spoke English, just because I could read and write, just because I could read a form and fill it in, you know, that all of these things were elements that put the American dream out of reach. Well, so many people.
Mm-hmm. They're working hard and they don't get
right.
the benefits that are
right. Exactly, sure.
Sure.
And just the basic minimums of a workplace situation. Of course, there were no toilets. Didn't bother me. I was a guy.
Mm-hmm.
But a tremendously serious problem for the women. I now realize, I didn't realize that at the time, no drinking water. Well, there was the irrigation system, and there was irrigation water running, and you could wash your head, and you could get a drink if you wanted. And the forewoman had ice water. It was a nickel. I think, I don't know whether she said you were paying for the cup or whatever, but it cost you a nickel. And she had sodas, that's what she wanted you to buy, which were a quarter or 50 cents or whatever.
And this started during the summer you went?
This was in June and July 1965, and we did about 2 months of work. And there was a rent strike going on at the labor camp. And this was the first contact I had with anyone from the union. And it was the person that I first met was a guy named Gil Padilla, who became a vice president of the union. He was a founding member. He's my compadre. He's my daughter's godfather. And he really organized me. And there was also Reverend Dave Havens and his wife, Suzanne Havens, that were working with the migrant ministry. And Gilbert from the union point of view and Dave Havens from the Christian point of view both really turned my life around. I was still a Republican, but all of a sudden had a real different view on life. And at the end of that summer, or I guess in July, there was a strike at a little place called Exeter Dehydrator. And it was guys from the labor camp were working at this place. I think they were doing raisins. I think it was mostly raisins.
Mm-hmm.
And all the guys that had worked there last year, they'd sent out the notice, you're all invited back, and it's $1.25 an hour. Well, more people showed up than they needed. So they said, we're going to make it $1.20 an hour. Because we have more than we need, and if you don't like $1.20, quit, leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys were furious. And we worked here last year at $1.25 an hour, and that's not fair. Lowering our wages, and you know, this is our jobs. And no, we're not going to quit. We're going to go on strike. And they went on strike, and all of a sudden they were out in the road, and here come the police. And so one of them came back and got me and said, oh, the police are there, and we need someone to talk to the police and what to do. So I went over. I wasn't on strike,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't a union. This was just what would be called a wildcat strike, but these were friends of mine. I knew them all. okay, I'll help you out. And right away I called Dave Havens. I said, what do? You know, a strike? I've never been in a strike before. Okay. So he checked in with the police, and you can stand here, but you can't stand there, and you can have signs, and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, you know. And that was, and then the next day, Caesar came by. It was my first experience meeting Caesar. And also the next day, Larry Itliong came by, who was the leader of the AWOC. Mm-hmm. And it turned out the guys picking the grapes were a Filipino crew that had signed up with AWOC. And they were wondering what was happening with the dehydrator, because the company didn't want the grapes unless they had the crew in the dehydrator. And so what was happening? I mean, everyone was wondering, what's happening? But it was one of those little shot in the dark things, you know. It was not planned, it was not organized. All the guys needed to work, so after about 2 or 3 days everyone began getting jobs somewhere else. The company
went out.
I think it was about 20.
20
out of 20. Everyone went out. Yeah. But then right, they shut it down for about 2 days. Mm-hmm. But right away he began getting other people. And I remember we went by this notice in Eugene Nelson's book, Quelga, that mentions me in the early days of the strike, that I was already a victim of strike breakers' fists. But what happened, we began getting the license numbers of the people that were working and going by and talking to them after work. And there was this young kid that had an old Ford, and we followed him, Farmersville was so small, we knew where, could spot where all the cars were. Mm-hmm. And so we went by there, and I went up to the door with Dave Havens and knocked on the door, and his dad came to the door, opened the door, and took the glasses off my nose and pow, just flattened me right out. And some of the workers were back in the car, you know, they were all ready to take him on and everything, and Dave Havens said, no, you know, keep them in the car. And I got up and said, well, I'm sorry you hit me, but gosh, we're not here to threaten you or anything, and we just wanted to explain what's going on. And started talking, and eventually he invited us in, and we had coffee, and I've been laid off, he said, and my son's going back to school, and this was a way for him to get money for school clothes, and I didn't even have money for shoes for him. And I was in a union back in somewhere. I mean, it wasn't that this was a vicious scab, you know, trying to steal someone else's wages. I mean, in every strike, you have very human stories and very poor people that need work. And here was a chance for this kid to pick up a little bit of extra money. And no, he didn't want to break the strike. And if he could find work anywhere else, he would. Mm-hmm. And ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And so as in 99% of farm labor strikes, this was a loser, mm-hmm. Sad to say. But each time you have a strike, I mean, you hope that somebody learns something from it. And certainly you can't, you know, there's a tendency, if you have power, you know, to say that this is evil and this is good, and yeah, which side are you on? I'm on the side of the strikers. Yeah. But they're very, very human stories involved in every situation.
And you were able to, even though you were struck,
mm-hmm.
you were able to take that attitude of, you know, this is someone who might have a greater...
Right, sure. And he was, you know, he was a brother. He was a scab, but he was a brother. Right. But then at the end of the summer, I had a 1935 Ford pickup truck with my means of transportation, bright canary yellow. And I thought this would be just perfect for my gardening business, which I assumed I was going into. And even at the end of the summer, was kind of thinking I would go back to Berkeley, where wages were better than that, and it wasn't the hot sun, and much better conditions, and in a sense, I'd be my own boss, because you're working for fairly wealthy people that have beautiful gardens, and your job is to maintain the garden, and as long as it's maintained in a beautiful condition, you know, the the person that's writing the check may or may not be a very, you know, much of a patron, you know, not watching over your shoulder. Oh, she'll want it done this way or that way. But if you have it looking nice, it's your...
But you might be able to set your own...
Right, your own hours and your own standards and so forth. But the union had just had a newspaper since, I think, Caesar printed the first issue of El Macriado in maybe December of 1964. And in the spring of 1965, they were issuing the paper fairly regularly, about every 2 weeks, twice a month. And he'd gotten a guy named Bill Escher to help him with the typing, the setup, the paste up, and especially the mailing and distribution. And at the end of the summer, they were had decided to bring out an English edition, especially geared to the young Chicanos that didn't read Spanish. And there were some blacks and some Filipinos that were beginning to get interested in the union. So we were going to bring out an English edition. And there were 2,000 copies in Spanish, and we were going to bring out 1,000 in English. Mm-hmm. And Bill Escher asked if I could come to Delano and help him with the English edition and also help with the distribution. And what he really wanted was the distribution, because we took the paper all the way down to Arvin and Lamont and Pumpkin Center. We had a little store in Pumpkin Center that sold the paper. And all through the Central Valley, out to Hanford, up to Madera, the other side of Fresno. And we would take an ice pick and punch a little hole in the corner of the paper and hang it on a piece of coat hanger. And we could hang the paper on the chewing gum rack right close to the cash register. And farm workers passing through, and these would be little rinky-dink stores. This wasn't Vons and Safeway. This was La Conchita's market in the barrio, you know, which might be a dirt road to get to it. And there would be some stores that we'd put 10 on the little rack, and we'd come back, and they'd sold 9. And it was on consignment, we would collect the money for the ones they sold. And it sold for a dime, and we'd collect a nickel. Well, it wasn't a big profit-making media conglomerate starting out. It was strictly a money-losing affair. But there was enough advertising in the paper that it more or less broke even, could pay for the gas. And Bill Escher wanted a volunteer to help distribute it. And I was that. I was it. And he said, there's plenty of work in the grapes. If you move to Delano, there's plenty of work in the grapes. They're labor camps. You can get a room in a labor camp, no problem. And you'll have lots of money. And you can help me out on weekends or whenever. It sounded great to me. And the night before I moved down there, the Filipinos went out on strike. They went out the 8th of September, 1965. So as I got to Delano, and it would be fascinating to get together Bill Escher and Eugene Nelson and Dolores and Helen and people that were there that week. We didn't know quite where we stood. The Filipinos had gone out on strike. They were affiliated with the AFL-CIO, so they had a bankroll behind them. They were part of an international organization. Mm-hmm. But we weren't sure how committed the AFL-CIO was to this strike. The union had $85 in their treasury. And right away, I think Dolores went down to Filipino Hall first. And we all got along fine with Larry and Philip and the old Filipinos that were farm workers. Mm-hmm. But the guy in charge was an Anglo that had been sent in by the AFL-CIO. Gosh, I've forgotten his name even.
He was an organizer?
He was the organizer and in charge of the budget, and his attitude was, if you want to help the strike, join AWOC, which was not what Caesar and Dolores, you know, had in mind at all. And they were suspicious of us, too. Are you going to try and take over our strike? This is our strike, you know, and we're trying to... What were they trying to do? We weren't quite sure. And we were also worried, and in farm labor there's always the problem of the growers splitting one ethnic group off against another. And in the grapes, it was the Filipinos against the Mexicans, and the locals against the people from Texas. And I mean, any kind of split that they could take advantage of, they would take advantage of. And the Filipinos were getting older. There were young Filipinos, but many of them were older. But we were worried that, maybe this was a strike to protect those companies that were mostly Filipino and protect those camps. I mean, we weren't quite sure what was happening.
Sure.
But there was strike fever everywhere. And the union had had a strike in the Roses that spring. A guy named Epifanio Camacho had been the leader of it. And they'd actually won a wage increase, as I remember. I wasn't involved in that. I wasn't in Delano at that time, but I think they'd won a wage increase. But the rose growers had blacklisted Epifanio Camacho, who was the leader, who was the best of all.
The rose strike was up in Watsonville?
No, it was in McFarland. It's a little town right south of Delano. Mount Arbor Roses, I think the company was called. And there'd been kind of wildcat strikes in the grapes, all starting in Coachella in May, and then in Arvin and Lamont in July. Coachella in June, I guess, and Arvin and Lamont in July. And here it was the first week in September, and it's breaking out all over Delano.
You said they were wildcat. Were they wildcat just because it was spontaneous?
Yeah, they just, and it's the workers decide to go out on strike, and it's just a spontaneous thing, and there's no planning, and there's no...
But they might have already been in a union or not?
Well, they were all members of the AWOC. Mm-hmm. They were members of the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, on their own, were sort of causing these...
Yeah, this wasn't something where somebody in San Francisco or Washington or somewhere planned a strike. You know, the workers said, we've had it. That's it. Not 1 more minute. And the AWOC structure was also based on the foremen, who were, again, older Filipinos. They were union members. The crew was loyal to them. If the foreman went out on strike, the crew would go with him. If the crew went out on strike and wanted the foreman to go with him, usually he would, even if he was kind of hesitant, because he had so many family ties, and they were all primos and cousins and from the same village or province in the Philippines. The crews were very tightly cohesive. Mm-hmm. And our union was predominantly Mexican-American. Or Mexican, what was our relationship to this strike? And we decided to call a meeting. I mean, gosh, what could be more all-American? You call a meeting. and passed out. So the job of the Malcriado, I'd barely gotten there, the job of the Malcriado is to get out the notice of this meeting all over the Central Valley, Lamont to Madera. And it was called for the 16th of September, which was Mexican Independence Day.
Well-timed.
And it was in the Catholic Church Hall in Delano. And if you go there, all the windows were donated, the stained glass windows were donated by the growers, the Zininovich family. They're mostly Croatians and Italians from the Dalmatian coast, mm-hmm. Catholics. The Divizic family, the Pendel family. And the priest was not for the union at all. I mean, he was very neutral. I mean, fanatically neutral. And the idea of having a strike vote in his hall, but Caesar assured him, oh no, this is to calm passions and we just want to make sure there's no violence and whatever. And the workers got there and Epifanio Camacho gave this tremendous speech about we are the sons of Zapata, and the land, like the air, like the water, belongs to the people and those who work it. And it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees, and on and on. And my Spanish was, I could barely follow it, but just a tremendous speech, and the electricity in that hall was just tremendous. And the crowd, there were thousands, well, probably a couple of thousand workers there. This was like we'd had 4 days to spread the word on this meeting, and it had gone all over the valley. Everybody, you know, was talking about it.
Did people come from all over
the valley? Oh, yes. Tremendous. And we were focusing on the grapes, but there were people there from everywhere. And by the end of the meeting, people were shouting, Huelga, 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 strike. From a strictly legal point of view, what did that mean? Were we joining the AWOC strike? Well, not quite. We went out on strike on our own. Mm-hmm. But in solidarity with them. I think that would be the specific way you would describe what happened. So there were two unions, but one strike. And almost immediately, the workers had no problem at all integrating the movement. I mean, they were our brothers and we were our brothers, and no problem. Their leadership was a little suspicious of us. And our leadership was a little suspicious of them, because it was two separate structures, and what if they decided to make a settlement? And but pretty quickly we agreed that we were in it together.
Were the two unions relatively the same size? Or?
Well, very quickly we became bigger. Mm-hmm. Very quickly we expanded tremendously. And Caesar's genius and Dolores's genius and Gilbert's genius, it seems to me, was that they realized that in the context of Delano, California, and Kern County, California, a strike would be defeated. That the growers had the police, they had the judges, they had the law, they had everything, the welfare departments, the banks. Everyone could be, locally, could be mobilized on their side to force the workers to go back to work or to bring in replacements. And that had been the history of agricultural strikes in this country for years and years and years. And Caesar's genius and Dolores' genius and Helen's genius and was to see that at this moment in American history there was a chance to, in effect, finesse this local power structure and appeal to the wider community. And my first job after that strike meeting was, and then the strike was called for the 20th. So when I first got to Delano, it was just almost immediately working on the leaflets and the Macriato to get out the news that there was going to be this. We had a Macriato already printed out that described the Filipinos going on strike, and we had a leaflet inserted into it that said, we're calling a meeting for September 16th. Mm-hmm. And then the strike was called for the 20th. So we had those 4 days to prepare for it. No money in the budget, no food, no flags, no lawyer, no nothing. I mean, we were farm workers. And right away, Caesar said, you know, we need allies, we need help, we need to get the word out. Who to call? There were 5 priests in the state of California who Caesar knew, all of them personally, who were sympathetic to workers. I mean, it's assumed today, oh, the Catholic Church is on the side of the union, and not so at all, not so at all. And in fact, there was an extremely anti-clerical feeling among many union members, because the church in Mexico had historically been an oppressor, a tremendous landowner, and 100% on the side of the growers and the power structure. And in general, that was true in California in 1965. And the few priests here and there who were sympathetic, Caesar knew them all personally. But just as he started to organize farm workers, or he and Dolores, and it's easy to say Caesar, but I want you to remember that it was a community. And Caesar was a brother in those days. And the press is focused on Caesar as the only one. But we were a family that were all working together. and we were brothers and sisters. And there was no sense that Caesar was the only one. And there would be tremendous disagreements between Caesar and Dolores. Caesar fired Dolores repeatedly. That doesn't get in the Union histories, but before the strike, they'd be in a disagreement, and one would walk out, and I quit, and you're fired. But, you know, it's like a family. You have these disagreements, and the next day you get back together, and there's a job to get done. Mm-hmm. And our appeal to these five priests was, give us all the help you can get, and it's your job to organize the church and get the church to help us. And this is where the church should be. And there had been enough change in the church after John the 23rd had come in, so that there were people in the church that were ready to help. I think we called, who did we know that were journalists? And I've forgotten who we called. We called the LA Times, and I think Harry Bernstein got up there about 2 weeks after the strike began. Mm-hmm. Sam Kushner was there the first week. Well, he was a reporter from the People's World. The Communist Party, for whatever you say about it, for however few members they actually had in California in 1965, maybe a couple of thousand, but boy, they were there to help and organizing within their unions and food starting to come in, and boom, they were there on our side. And there came a point in the union when there were people that were very much opposed to the communists in the union. Oh, and they have their own agenda, and we need to purge the communists. But certainly to me, the strength in those days was that I, a Republican, could be picketing next to a communist, and we're brothers and sisters, and there's a job to get done, and there's a big tent, and boy, everyone that can help, get your ass down here and help out. May have to edit that one out of the thing, but and union people, and again, there were in unions all over the state, there were people that were ready to help, ready to do something, and if their unions were just sitting around not doing the job that needed to be done in their particular industry, let's go help the farm workers.
Did unions come in on this first strike?
No, I would guess the first union delegation probably, but the first union delegation came down before the end of September.
Mm-hmm. So once it was on?
Almost as soon as it began, we began having people coming down. I think in that first week of picketing, there weren't many outsiders, there were very few. There was Kathy Lynch, who's now Kathy Magia, came down. It was from the Catholic worker community in Oakland. Well, the Catholic workers, again, to me, they represented the kind of the political, spiritual feeling that I would say was the most important in the union. We had communist members, we had capitalist members, we had Catholics, we had Pentecostals and Jehovah's Witnesses. Certainly the AFL-CIO had no commitment to nonviolence, for instance. There were people in the union who had direct experience, old-timers, who had direct experience with the Mexican Revolution, and certainly many people who had a second-hand experience with the Mexican Revolution, and knew that at some point in their villages, the workers, the peasants, had taken the land, had gotten rid of the landlords. They had won, and it was temporary. It might not have lasted for long, but it was a vision, a dream, that when El Malcriado said the land should belong to the people, right on. It's hard to visualize that in 1995. The world has changed so much. But in those days, even the American government was promoting land reform in other countries, certainly not in the Central Valley of California. Yeah. But for other countries, that seemed to be a reasonable proposal. And gosh, when we proposed it, you know, when we said, how about that for here? I mean, we weren't even saying it. It was farm workers saying, you know, in Mexico and the ejidos, and well, the ejido situation is, you know, a mixed success, but there was a vision at that time that, yes, the land should belong to the people. In the Filipino community, at that time in the Philippines, there was an extremely corrupt so-called democratic regime dominated by landlords, which has changed minimally, mm-hmm. perhaps, since then. But in those days, in 1965, there was also a very militant and partially successful alternative. The Hakbala Hop was led by Luis Tarrak. And at that point in 1965, if you were a poor Filipino, you were weighing these options. Which was better? You knew that under Marcos, you were a loser. And the Hakbala Hop was offering an alternative that seemed viable. Yeah. Certainly looked better than the existing situation that you were living in. And the first week of the strike, when the Pagliarulo packing shed burned with something like 100,000 lugs of grapes in it, our feeling was, that's our hucks. And, you know, we were for nonviolence, but if the hucks took care of the packing shed, it wasn't our place to say, that's a no-no, you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a tremendously radical vision out there. Mm-hmm. And Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert were on a different level as part of the Catholic worker tradition in saying, look, there's a real chance to change the terms of the struggle and to use nonviolence to win. But so there was still the dream to win meant to win the land, to win a lot more than 5 cents an hour, to win a lot more than, you know.
Would you say that the Catholic worker movement was the focus for the nonviolent, and then there were other elements that focused the more
traditional, shall we say?
Or whatever.
Well, I won't say radical, because the Catholic worker tradition, to me, was what I felt comfortable with, and it seemed to me extremely radical. And I joined the union because I liked farm work, I wanted to farm. I consider myself a peasant. Mm-hmm. And looking to the future in the society that we wanted to build, is it less radical to want to build it through nonviolent means? Well, not necessarily so. But the end goal at that point was a radical vision. It wasn't an extra nickel. It wasn't an extra dime. It was justice. It was dignity. It was the growers treating us with respect. That was the bottom line. You know, and if you got the nickel or the dime or whatever, that was part of the contract. But the bottom line was respect.
Was there a feeling that if you didn't come to control the land, that is, get the land, that you couldn't get respect, or was that just part of it?
The land's a dream, mm-hmm. you know. And the strike, the immediate goal of the strike was the $1.40 an hour, you know. So, but the underlying demand, the bottom line demand, was the respect, that they sit down at a table with us and treat us with respect, and we reach a mutual agreement, and we sign it, and my signature counts just as much as yours. And if you don't have my signature, the crop doesn't get picked.
And had it been organized to a level of presenting, for example, $1.40 as the target?
I've forgotten when we came up with the $1.40. I think that was the Filipinos' demands, and that was fine with us. I mean, the general wages then were $1.25. The $1.40, I think, had been the demand in Coachella, and I think they had gotten it, and that's why it was attainable. The $1.40 was attainable, and the respect was attainable in this day and age, you know, September 1965. And the talk of the land, I'm just interjecting that to remind people in 1995 that the ultimate goal was much more than the extra dime of 15 cents. It was a vision of society in which the people that worked the land and produced the food had a say in their own lives.
I think it's very hard to see what the importance of each of these are if you don't say it, because from our perspective today, $1.25 to $1.40, you're still starving.
Right.
So, but at that time, you really felt like it was not an outrageous demand. The growers could meet this under negotiation. They could come and sign. So these are all serious negotiations.
And what we assumed was that they would raise the wage to the $1.40 but refuse to sign. And what we were saying was, we're not going to go back until you sign the contract. Okay, that was the difference between this strike and other strikes. Because it's my impression they got the $1.40 in Coachella when they struck in May, the Filipinos, at least at the David Friedman Company.
But
it was much more than that 15 cents.
But you wanted to hold them to the idea of recognizing
right.
the dignity of the labor.
Right.
Those sorts of issues.
And so the whole seniority system and everything else that became part of the contract wasn't specifically economic. As this, then that happens. It's you have a procedure for resolving that, and that's the grievance procedure. And the whole, and where the AWOC kind of at first was nervous with Caesar was, and with our union, was that it was such a broad view that that's part of it, but also part of it is in your daily lives. The union is there to help you get that respect when you have to go to court, when your kids are in school, when you're dealing with a bank. I mean, in the union was a whole life policy, how to say it, where you were part of the family, and we were all in this together to improve our lives and those of our children.
So the union provided part of the social services?
Yeah. And again, part of it was that we were watching what was happening in the civil rights movement in the South. Are you still going?
I'm dead.
It was... Are you back on?
I don't know. Are there a lot of people who join the union from your background?
Well, and people began coming down by the end of September. More and more people were coming. When I was there, there were three Anglos. There was me and Eugene Nelson and Bill Escher. And then Kathy Lynch was the first outsider who came to help. And then a couple of guys came from SNCC, Mississippi. The Mississippi summer was just ending up. Bob Solido and Bob Fisher, the two Bobs. By the end of September, there may have been a dozen. By Christmas, there may have been, well, helping the union, maybe thousands. I mean, it mushroomed right quickly. But there wasn't a place to keep everybody in Delano, and increasingly, people that volunteered were recruited and plugged into their own local communities to organize the boycotts and what was happening out there, organize food caravans to bring stuff down.
How long did it take to start getting that sort of outreach, I guess?
I think the first article appeared in the LA Times like the first week in September, in October. And by then, we'd already hit, unions were very much aware of us. We made it an effort right from the first to reach these outside communities.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, the first public figure to come down was Steve Allen, who had written a book about farm labor and was real interested in farm labor on a personal level, and came down, met Caesar, and was very interested in what was happening. He said he would do everything he could to help. Oh, did you? Well, we were just, you know, most farm workers had no idea who he was. He wasn't part of their culture. And the power structure in Delano was just furious. Why is this comedian coming to town? And he knows nothing about farm labor. And but he was, to us, it was tremendous to have someone, you know, with contacts, gosh, all over the country, who was willing to take his time to really, and I gather, really did do a lot of work, calling and here and there, and almost immediately it was evident that this was not a flash-in-the-pan strike, that it wasn't going to be a, you know.
Did it start on time? Did it start on the 20th?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the first, I remember the night before the strike, Dolores and I were at the Guadalajara having a late night. We'd been printing leaflets till, you know, 11, and we went over for a little late night something or other, and the place was packed, and everyone talking about the strike. And Dolores said, this is a very good sign, because if people are going to work at 4 a.m., they're not going to be up this late. And the first day, Dolores and I and Tony Mendez were in charge of the little town of Richgrove, which is to the east of Delano. And we were to meet at Apollonio Flores' house. And we were to get there at 4 a.m. And his mom, or he was like a maybe 18, 19, real good-looking young Chicano guy. And his mom had atole and hot coffee, and he already had lieutenants for each block in the little town. The little town had probably 500 people, 800 people, little tiny five or six streets. And so our main job was any house that had a light on, we went and knocked on the door, and are you going to go on strike? And so we had about 2 hours before it got light to make sure that if you were up that early, it was because you were going to go picketing with us and not going to go break the strike. And it was a little town where everyone knew everyone. And I would say the strike was like 99% effective for that little town. Mm-hmm. And then once it got light, we had a big car caravan, and we went up to the Carrick farm, as I remember. And there was a crew in there working, but they were so far in, they couldn't hear us calling to them. But we were picking out on the road, and there were different groups all over the valley that had come out from Delano, and then we would hear that somebody else had brought a crew out at this ranch or that ranch. But I would say with that first week, it was probably, well, hard to judge, but 60-80% in that range effective. It was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately the growers began trying to bring in people from Bakersfield, which was farther to the south, and bringing in people from Fresno and Visalia, which was farther to the north, and bringing in Puerto Ricans, bringing in blacks. Always they would play the racial card, try to bring in a group that, you know, wasn't Filipino, wasn't Mexican.
Your contact person in Richgrove was Apollonio Flores.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 18 or 19 years old. Was mm-hmm. it common for the people who were at that level organizing to be that young? Is that something?
Well, the meeting on the 16th of September, everybody signed union cards for the ranches they worked at. For instance, that was my first authorization card. I signed for Red Banks Fruit Company and for Nash DeCamp. Well, they weren't really grape growers. Nash DeCamp had grapes. But it was kind of, it was up in Tulare County, really by Visalia. But we would, then we organized the cards, who's in this ranch, who's in that ranch, and also organized by towns. And he was one of the guys that had volunteered. And a lot of the people that volunteered were young guys that were, you know, they heard the speeches, they're valientes, they're full of vim and vigor, they're not afraid of anything. The same with some of the young women. Just fearless. And there were older guys that also moved right into leadership positions. But lots of young guys, and that were tremendous. And Tony Mendez, who was the other person, he was from Early Mart. Well, his dad was a labor contractor. And he was also a teenager. But he later went over to the Teamsters, and then he became anti-union, and he was one of these people that kind of, the Union opened his eyes to the bigger world and wider world, but kind of what we call a yuppie today. He was on the way up, you know, and the Teamsters paid more money, and then the growers paid more money, and he used his skills that he learned in the Union to fight unions. And he's still an anti-labor consultant. I think he's made a fairly good living as an anti-labor consultant. So most of the people that we brag about, oh, this organizer went on to become a mayor, and this organizer went on to become a lawyer, and this organizer went on to become whatever. Well, he went on to become an anti-labor consultant, but there weren't very many of those. And we blame that on his family origins, because his dad was a labor contractor.
I noticed you mentioned that.
Yeah. But
overall, then, the first strike was successful in the sense of at least getting people out.
The first week, yeah.
The first week. And then from there, what
Right away, though, we had all this energy and all these people, and okay, what about the grapes that are picked? Almost immediately we began following trucks of grapes to the Los Angeles terminal and began picketing there. And
did you go down to LA yourself?
I personally didn't. I was working on the Mal Criado, so if I wasn't on the picket line, I was putting out the paper. Mm-hmm. And we had a two-person staff, and then two young students from a Catholic high school in Bakersfield came to help us, Mary Murphy and Marsha Brooks. And basically, the four people put out a staff in a room that's probably from the light back to here. And
did you stay on the Mal Criado for as long as you were involved, or did you go
on? I stayed on for the Mal Criado all through 65, 66. Then by 66, Bill Escher more or less moved out of the actual day-to-day work of the Mal Criado, so I was the editor. Late 66 into 67, there was a guy named Daniel de los Reyes. My Spanish was so bad that if I could find someone else to do the actual writing in Spanish, I would bring him in. And I certainly didn't have any power trip problems about me wanting to be the boss. I just, you know, you wanted to get the paper out. And in fact, I made all kinds of mistakes that the board would call me in and just read me the riot act, and how could you do something so stupid, and gosh, I'm sorry. You know, you're right, it was. But you're under so much pressure. We were in the DiGiorgio campaign in 1966, which was a very multiracial workforce, and we were trying to appeal to the Anglos there, which were about a third of the workforce at DiGiorgio. And the organizers wanted us to tone down the Mexican part of the paper. I mean, not eliminate it, but just to stress that we were multiracial and multicultural and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And we were putting out one paper right at the height of the campaign, and, you know, it's 2 a.m., and you have to leave by 4 to get to Fresno to get the paper to the printer so it can be printed so you can get back in time for ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, and what picture to put on the cover. And there was this beautiful picture of Carolina Franco in this huge sombrero, and she had a candle, and it was the mass, and it was dark, and this very dramatic picture. Boom, it went on, and we came back, and Fred Ross, who was in charge of organizing, was furious. Here's a totally Catholic, totally Latina cover on the paper, and we're trying to project this Anglo multiracial. Oh, and ta 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 ta. Well, gosh, yeah, I am sorry and mistake. And usually, when Caesar and Dolores called me in on something like that, they were right. I have to admit, you know, I made mistakes, but they were good faith mistakes. But there were other. There was another article we ran on the Teamsters had come in by then, and they were trying to represent the workers at DiGiorgio. And so we ran an article on the Teamsters, and they'd had a sweetheart contract with Bud Antle for years. And we ran a story on this contract based on interviewing workers. What had happened? Well, they sued us for libel right quick for $27 million or something or other.
To shut down the paper.
Right, whatever. But at that point, the union had no lawyer. I mean, it's serious to be sued for libel. On the other hand, we had no assets. what are they going to get? But so at that point, the union was sort of trying to distance itself from the newspaper. I'm getting into the newspaper a lot, and,
yeah,
but Carlos can come back and do this. But the El Mal Criado was sort of theoretically, nominally being published by the Farm Worker Press. Well, who was the Farm Worker Press? Well, whoever we said it was. I mean, who hired me? Bill Escher sort of hired me, and then when he quit, I hired myself, you know. Did the union executive board give us orders? Well, yeah, we were there to serve them. But when they got sued, or when the paper got sued, they wanted to say, oh, we have no connection with these people there. They wrote it, we didn't, you know, whatever, anyway. But so my time with the paper, and by that time, we were up to about 14,000 copies in English and 12,000 in Spanish and all over the valley. And when the march went to Sacramento, every little village that we went into, our subscribers in those villages, we'd go into Parlier, you know, or some little town like that, Del Rey, there'd be a little community of people that knew all the personalities in the union, all the issues, I mean, had been following the story, and we'd hit a town like Parlier, and every house would be open to us, you know, and all the women of the community would make the food, and there'd be a rally, and I mean, it was just like...
Because of the Mal Criado.
Because of the Mal Criado, and it had been all up and down
was
the valley.
Was your name associated by now? Did people recognize you?
My name, I don't think it ever appeared in the paper.
Mm-hmm. It was just the Mal Criado itself represented.
But I was called El Mal Criado in those days. My nickname was either Pato or El Mal Criado. And but I don't think we ever printed, there was never anything that said Editor Doug Adair. Maybe once or twice. I think for the post office we had to do something once a year for our mailing permit.
From the Mal Criado to some other.
Yeah, and then in 1967, I went to Texas and opened a newspaper, the Mal Criado Texas edition. That was when we had a strike down there in the Mellons.
Mm-hmm.
And was
that
there for...
The
right. But by then, the board was... The paper had become so famous that it was like a lightning rod that was attracting attention. And, I mean, we were just... outrageous, how to put it. And it would come to Caesar's attention when someone would complain that, oh, you said this about the AFL-CIO, or you said this about the Democrats, or you said this about somebody that objected to something we said. It wasn't farm workers, it was usually someone outside the union, but we were printing so many copies in English now that it had a big distribution in the support community. And the coalition that was supporting us was so diverse that it was very easy to offend somebody. And it happened constantly. And the complaints would come back to Caesar. And while I was in Texas, he let the paper die. And so there was no Mal Criado for about 6 months in California. And I was still printing in Texas. And the paper had enough money to support itself, but we weren't ever getting any money from the union in those days. Never got a penny from the union. Advertising and sales covered us.
How long were you in Texas?
About 8 months. And that Gilbert Padilla was in charge of the organizing campaign there, and I was arrested in Mission and was part of the lawsuit Madrano et al. Versus the Texas Rangers. which went all the way to the Supreme Court and overturned dozens of the vicious Texas labor laws. But when I came back to Delano at Christmas that year, Dolores said, we really want to get the paper going back again in California, but we want it under day-to-day control of the board, and we don't want any misunderstandings. And every issue of the paper in paste-up will be submitted to the union lawyers before it goes to press. I said, well, whatever, you know, I'm here to serve, fine with me. And I...
On the Texas, as I recall, the Texas strike was somewhat controversial.
Right, very. And we had just won contracts, the first contracts in California, $1.75 an hour. It was the march to Sacramento, and Schenley Liquor Industry had signed the contract because of the boycott. Not because we'd won the strike in the fields, but because they were very susceptible to the boycott. And we'd begun, Eugene Nelson had been on the boycott in Houston and went down to Rio Grande City at the urging of various people in the Texas labor movement just to see what was happening down there. And it's like a third world country. It makes California look rich, California agriculture.
I'm
really smiling. Little villages with dirt roads and mud huts and 50 cents an hour, you know, 30 cents an hour. And the workers there heard about the union, the success in California, and boy, they were out on strike almost immediately. And the union in California was horrified because we just barely gotten started, barely gotten our foot in the door in California, and here all of a sudden there are 1,000 workers on strike in the Mellons in Texas. Again, no money, no planning, no lawyers, no staff, no typewriters, no office, no nothing. And 1,000 workers on strike, and you need more than just enthusiasm to win. And it was also, gosh, from a historical perspective, the Communist Party, you know, when they won in Russia, there was this great division, you know, can you build socialism in one country? Or Trotsky's vision was, you know, spread it around and just have the workers rise up everywhere. And of course they'll be defeated in most places, but you want to encourage the revolution to break out everywhere. So kind of the feeling in Delano was that division, you know, do you want to just let this thing go out of control and start here and there? And you're going to see tremendous suffering and strikes defeated, you know, and no, let's concentrate on California. And there was another division that said, this is a special moment in history, you know, and let it explode. It's like, if you've read the plan of Delano, it's like sparks in the dry grass of the prairie, you know. It's flaring up everywhere, and let it happen.
Well, you went right off to South Texas. Were you part of the let it explode?
Well, by the time I got there, it was almost a year old, and in fact, we made one more try that next June and had some successes, but Gilbert's job really was to fold up shop, that it wasn't a strike that had any future. And I mean, it wasn't in so many words, but how to get out of this with our honor, you know, and not abandoning the workers, but we've got a job to do in California, and let's put our resources there.
So 8 months later, you come back to California under the new conditions for the operation.
Right. And I hope you get some good interviews with Bill Chandler about Texas.
Well, I understand because, being a ranch.
Yeah, because to me, the brief time I was there, I kind of sympathized with the California view that we needed to concentrate in California. But it seems to me, even though the strike was defeated in Texas and was only a brief 2-year chapter, that the repercussions there were tremendous and just a ripple effect through the whole Texas labor movement, through the whole Chicano social movement, through the Democratic Party, through the Catholic Church. Texas has never been the same. And the migrant stream that starts in Texas goes to Ohio, goes to Wisconsin, goes to California again. Those two brief years really made a difference, made a tremendous difference. And when I came back to California, by that time the paper was more geared to the boycott. And we had a Spanish edition, but most of our effort was going into the English edition at that point. And we had a new editor named David Fishlow, who was very good in Spanish, much more diplomatic in getting along with the different members of the board. And I was, in effect, the publisher at that point. And David worked under me, but I was in charge of the department. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened I had reserve skills in accounting and bureaucratic whatever, that, gosh, the board was very impressed with my work because I was making money hand over fist, and we were selling buttons. When I'd been in Texas, kind of hungry times, how to make money, we went up to Texas and printed a poster that had Emiliano Zapata, and it said, Viva la Revolucion. And totally unauthorized by Caesar and the board, but it just made money hand over fist. It just came out in 1968, and within a year it was like radical chic. You had to have that poster in your room. Everybody had that poster. And we had the new book by George Ballas, Basta. We had Huelga by Eugene Nelson. We had buttons. We had bumper stickers. So it was a whole mail order business sold through El Macriado, generating tremendous amounts of money.
Was it headquartered in
Belen? Yeah, we were the first functioning office at the 40 acres. They gave us, and we had an office about the size of this room.
But it sounds like you're moving more into administrative kind of
work. That was a more administrative job then. I was still writing quite a bit for the paper, but I was running I was more the administrator of the show. And had a beautiful garden surrounding our office, and one of the other people on the staff was Rudy Reyes. And he and I had just a fantastic garden out there. But it was more geared to the boycott, and it was clear that the boycott was going to be the way we could finesse the grape growers. And in 1970, almost everyone was being sent out on the boycott, and I was sent to Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, and was working with Gilbert Padilla again, a lot of the high points in my union career with Gil Padilla, and I hope you get a chance to really do some interviewing with him. I don't think he's going to be down here this weekend. He's had some ill health, but just a tremendous story to tell. But
so you went to Philadelphia in 1970.
It was like March of 1970, and David Friedman signed in April. So we had union grapes to offer, or the potential of union grapes to offer to the chain stores. And so it shifted the boycott from don't buy union grapes to don't buy grapes to how to use union grapes, you know, in a positive sense to promote the boycott of non-union grapes. And our strategy was especially geared to the unions, but also to the churches and a whole big coalition of supporters. My district was actually Delaware County, which was the area south of Philadelphia and includes Chester, Pennsylvania, and it's kind of partly rural and partly suburban. Mm-hmm. My first contacts were Quakers. There's a big Quaker community there. The Catholic Church, too, but even more the Quakers. And my first union contact, it was a little labor council in Delaware County, but they had a Scott paper plant, which was a big factory, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people. And the first action we had there was we handed out leaflets at the Scott paper plant, giving the home phone number of the regional supervisor for produce for Acme Markets. This was our target. And we asked the Scott Paper guys to please call this guy and ask him to handle union harvested grapes, which would be available. And that obviously if enough customers asked for Hunt's ketchup, they were going to stock Hunt's ketchup. And we were asking you to ask him to stock Union Harvested Crepes. Well, he had to change his phone number. He had so many thousands of phone calls within the next 2 or 3 week period. But got the message through real well. By the time the grape harvest began in June, we had Union grapes. I think there were two markets that agreed to handle only Union grapes. And A&P had some Union and some non-Union, and we were focusing on Acme.
By markets, you mean chains?
These were chains, yeah. And I think Acme markets, I had about, I probably had 20 in my county to work on. And we would pick, we would target specific Acmes close to a group of Union supporters that we could get out on the picket line. And it was an out-and-out secondary boycott. We were saying, don't shop at Acme markets. Acme's is buying non-Union grapes. And we're trying to convince the management that the people of Delaware County really do care. And if you could shop at some other market just for today, this way it gives the message to Acme markets that people in this area really do care. And we would, in Delaware County, I'd have usually maybe three during the week, and then there was no market, they had blue laws, so no shopping on Sunday. So we'd have a big picket line on Saturday, maybe three little ones during the week. And at a little market, I would have maybe three or four other people helping me pick it, maybe a student, maybe a woman from the church, maybe a couple of Union guys. And we could turn away 20, 30, 40 cars, say, in an evening. People, real sympathetic, and why not? And we'd choose a store where there was another one right across the street. Oh, I don't like A&P. Well, I know it's an inconvenience, but just for today, could you go and shop at the A&P because we're really trying to convince. Well, I cash my checks here. Well, when you go cash your check, can you please talk to the manager and tell them that this is important and it's important to the farm workers of America and you feel strongly and we can tell him, but he's going to listen to you because you shop here every week and he really will listen to you. Oh, I've never talked to him. Just talk to him and... It's just the power of the consumers, if they want to use it, is tremendous. And in the whole Philadelphia area, we would have 30 to 40 picket lines a week against Acme markets. And most of them would be, you know, 20 or 30 cars you're turning away, maybe a couple of thousand dollars. But the Saturday picket lines, we would shut down the store. The parking lots would be empty. We could... And the retail clerks were very strongly on our side, would give us the details from inside the market. You cost this store between $12,000 and $14,000 on Saturday morning. You cost this store between $8,000 and $10,000 on Saturday morning. They laid off all the meat cutters. They had to send the meat out because there's no market Sunday, and they shifted it to some other store. So for the little... The few pennies difference in profit that they would make, whether they're selling Union or non-Union grapes, I mean, it was crazy of them to fight us. And it became obvious to everyone that it was a political decision, that they were in solidarity with the growers just because they didn't want their consumers to have that power over them. And then when they finally agreed to give in, they printed full-page ads in the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Examiner, air special this week, air freighted from California, Union Harvested Grapes. Huge, great eagle on the full-page ad.
In solidarity.
We'd won. And it was, gosh, what a tremendous feeling that you'd mobilized literally hundreds of thousands of people.
Were secondary boycotts illegal?
They're illegal under the National Labor Relations Act, but farm workers are excluded from that. It doesn't apply to
so
us.
So they weren't bringing out police?
Oh, lots of police. And I wasn't arrested in Philly, but lots of people were. And they tried to get injunctions, they tried to do this and that, but again, it becomes totally political, and in a situation like Philadelphia, unlike a little village like Delano, the power structure is so diverse that when they go to court to get their injunction, the labor movement is there to oppose it, because the labor movement wants to defend the rights to picket, and the retail clerks especially. And in fact, the retail clerks were negotiating behind the scenes, even though we would be hurting their members sometimes when they'd get laid off on a Saturday. They wanted to defend the right to picket a store, and gave us all kinds of inside information about the power struggle that was going on within the corporation, because of course there were people in the corporation that said, why on earth are we fighting over this? What a waste of time! What terrible public relations! And there were fasts in front of their office, and I mean, we did all kinds of things. But my actual, when I was there, mostly I was organizing picket lines and leafleting and organizing phone-ins. We would organize phone-ins. For instance, we'd go to a church in an area and ask that they all phone the manager, the store. And these were, you know, all, you know, shoppers with kids, and please, and a very Christian please. But it isn't like, you know, firebombing and throwing rocks. It's a kind of please that's hard to say, no, you're all communists, and no, go back to where you came from, outside agitators. So it worked.
How long were you in Philadelphia?
Year, a little over a year. Then they asked me to stay on because the lettuce strike had started. And so Gilbert went back and a new group came out. And it was led by this young seminarian, this sweet baby-faced young seminarian from Washington, Richie Ross, who's now a big-time political consultant with Willie Brown. And I think he ran Lundgren's campaign for attorney general, has a reputation for being just a real, how do you say, I don't want to say scuzzbutt, but he runs real dirty political campaigns. But in those days, he was a sweet seminarian and a Christian youth, and this was in the lettuce boycott. And I'd never worked in the lettuce, and I felt more detached from the lettuce, but I did my best. And then they transferred us over, Harriet Teller and me, to St. Louis. And we worked there for about 8 months.
Who went with you to St. Louis?
Harriet Teller. And she works for National Public Radio in Michigan now.
So you went over to St. Louis and were doing lettuce boycott?
Mm-hmm, this was the same. And it was kind of off again, on again. It was the lettuce boycott was more complicated.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get back to work in the field, so that December of 1971, I went back to Delano. I'd written to the union that I planned to retire from the staff and take advantage of the union benefits we'd won, and went to Delano, to the hiring hall in Delano, in like the first week in December 1971, and asked for their, who's hiring? Oh, well, everybody's hiring for the pruning. I said, well, I need a labor camp. I don't have anywhere to live. Well, okay, and these are the companies with labor camps. And I said, is there any chance, you know, where my friend Rudy Reyes is working? He was a real good Filipino friend of mine that had worked on the union newspaper. And I was sure he was somewhere in Delano working in the grapes. Oh, he's out at Tenneco. He's on the ranch committee. Tenneco Ducor, camp number one. It's up near Porterville. And I said, well, are there any dispatches for there? Well, they'll be on Wednesday and be here at 8 o'clock on Wednesday. And so I was there. And maybe I'll focus a little here on how the union contract works and the advantages to someone like me, but I'll mention some of the disadvantages too. If you're from outside the area and you're going in fresh, it's a tremendous convenience to have all the job opportunities there in one room. And this company has a camp. The wages were all the same, basically. This company had a camp. This company's mostly Arabians. This company is mostly Puerto Ricans. This company is mostly people from Richgrove. These are families. these are marihuanosos, you know, these are winos, a lot of smoking in this crew. You can almost choose and pick, you know, what kind of crew you want to be in. The disadvantage was, if you were an old-time seniority worker, under the new contracts, you had seniority in that company. But you had seniority from the date the contract started, which was 1970 for most of the companies, the summer of 1970. So if by any chance you had worked for that company maybe for years and years off and on, but weren't there in 1970, and you came back in 71, you're not on the list. Okay, but there's still openings.
But without the seniority?
But without the seniority. Your seniority starts the day you start working under the contract. I think that's the way most companies work, though some of them may have granted seniority going back. There was a lot of resentment among some union members. We've been out on the picket lines for years and years. Why don't we have any seniority? And some people felt very bad about that. But it didn't bother me because I happened to come back when there were plenty of jobs and I moved right into a job.
But if you had not, if it had been a period where there was not as much hiring, you would have had to wait
right
through other people.
Right. No matter how many years they put in for the union. And I think for your union history, you should put me down as one of the, I'll claim to be in the top 10 seniority for union seniority, mm-hmm. which was never formalized, but we talked about it a lot then, and in which your union seniority begins when you sign your authorization card, regardless of when you're working or not. So my union seniority begins September 16th, 1965, and I don't think there are many people that go back mm-hmm. past then. Because people that were on staff never worked in the fields. I mean, obviously, Dolores and Julio were in the union before me, but Dolores, I don't think, has ever worked under contract. Most of the, and RD people in the union now, leadership, came way after I did.
When they organized things to let you know this crew is Filipino or whatever, mm-hmm. those sorts of distinctions could also be the source of some problems. But did you feel like this was an appropriate kind of activity to divide crews up ethnically?
Well, the union wasn't dividing them up that way. That's just happened to be lots of Arabs would tend to congregate in certain crews. And before the union came in, the camp tended to be run by the foreman of that crew. And it was generally run for profit. And the foreman would bill the workers in that crew for food and would probably make a profit on the food, maybe a dollar a day, maybe a dollar a meal. Might bill them for transportation from the camp to the field. He might have his own personal van and you'd pay a dollar a day or whatever. Might also sell wine, cigarettes. The prostitutes that serviced the camp might be giving the foreman a payoff. There was a whole society there which the foreman controlled. It was like his little world. When the union came in, of course, it disrupted that whole system very significantly, more in some crews than others. But in our crew, it became totally disruptive. The foreman in our crew discriminated very openly against the Arab workers. The Arab workers had to pay a dollar for a mattress fee before they could come in. They paid extra for food. They paid transportation fees. He very openly discriminated against them. When the union came in, not only did that end, but because the union gave dispatches out on a non-discriminatory basis, all of a sudden what had been a crew that had been mostly Filipino and maybe a quarter Arab was now almost half Arab. And they just happened to have Rudy there, and there was another ex-union staff member, Macario Bustos, both of whom had been very strong union organizers. And Macario had left staff because of a drinking problem. And, you know, he had a problem and he still had the problem in the camp. but just a tremendously strong Union person. And when he was going to town, our camp was about, oh, it's about 12 miles outside of town. When he was going to town, he'd say, I'm going to town, anyone need a ride? Need anything from town? Well, what had been a $5 or $10 expense for an Arab worker to say, get razor blades, you know, or something basic, all of a sudden became, my brother's going to town, you know, and sure, chip in something for the gas. But it was a whole different relationship that undercut the foreman's power just right off. The problem, or a problem that arose, was that especially Filipinos that had considered this camp their home, now they went to the foreman to get a job, and he said, no, you have to go to the Union. What do you mean I have to go to the Union? I'm from your same province. My wife's sister is your comadre's mother-in-law or whatever. I mean, all these relationships all of a sudden counted for nothing. You had to go to the Union. You had to get the hiring hall. And it was quite possible also they'd get to the Union and no one would speak English. And so there was... Any system is going to benefit some people more than others. And this system didn't benefit the people that had had a special privileged position in the old system, which was especially the Filipino community. So that's why you tended in the elections in 1976, 75, 76, 77. That's why the Filipinos tended to vote against the Union and tended to vote in favor of the Teamsters. And they had some legitimate reasons for doing that. It wasn't that they were traitors or whatever. There were some legitimate problems.
Ready